This question is for the rabbi. The Jewish, since the making of the Jewish state Israel, and the making of it has been very controversial, as you know. And all the since its inception 63 years ago, and all the human rights organization has condemned the Israeli and the Jewish state for its practices that against the Palestinians. And I was wondering how you feel about that, being a Jewish state. And you may add to that, please. What is the connection between Judaism and Zionism? Thank you very much.
Please don't ask hard questions. This is a very painful question, and it's a very painful situation. And in the world of political... You want me to repeat the question? The Swami asked me to repeat the question. The question was, what is the relationship between Judaism and Zionism? And what do I personally, I imagine it was addressed to me personally, what do I personally think of the state of Israel, given the fact that the questioner says that all human rights groups have condemned Israel for anti-human rights activities, non-human rights activities. So in the world of political polemics, there's not much to say that will be that I understand that I believe will be heard well. And this is clearly extraordinarily complicated, but I'll address it briefly because on some level it has to do with what we've been talking about here today, which is the search for God. Most of what I will say is simply my own personal opinion. I don't speak for any organization or any group or any particular ideology or philosophy. I speak only, at least at this moment, only in terms of my own personal philosophy. So let me begin by saying that I believe that there is a historical imperative that requires there to be a Jewish state, that 2,000 years of powerlessness for the Jewish people resulted in death, in persecution, and in death, and ultimately in the most vile form of systematic and strategic form of annihilation that the human race has known. Although there have been other kinds of annihilations and murders and killings and genocide that qualify as Holocausts, that without a Jewish state, and the ability for the Jewish people to embrace power, that they would be once again and forevermore at the mercy of powers greater than they. And frankly, 2,000 years of history has shown exactly what road that leads to. And that is an untenable position. I would secondly want to say that there is no moral imperative that states that a people has to lay down its arms and allow other people to kill it without the right to defend itself. Thirdly, I would say that the embrace of power and sovereignty on the part of the Jewish people for the first time in 2,500 years or so requires of the Jewish people as a whole and the people of Israel, the citizens of Israel in particular, to consider how one uses power in the world and how one uses power ethically. If you were to ask my personal opinion, I would say that there is a great deal that the state of Israel does that I do not approve of. On the other hand, there is a great deal of what the Palestinian people do that I also do not approve of. I pray fervently every day for peace. It is my belief and my understanding that in order for there to be peace, peoples on both sides of the conflict are going to have to change dramatically. They're going to have to change the way they educate their children. They're going to have to change the way they educate themselves. They're going to have to change their attitude towards violence. They're going to have to change their attitude towards honor killing. They're going to have to change their attitude towards each other. And find a willingness to speak to each other face to face and heart to heart. I fervently and passionately believe that if people in the Middle East were able to speak to each other with the same kind of feeling with which we have addressed the topic of conversation today, which is the yearning for God, if people were able to address each other from that understanding, from that mindset, the world would be a dramatically different place and peace would be able to be found. It is my most fervent wish.
Okay, for Rabbi, my question is, I promise it's going to be a very simple one. It's not a hard. As you mentioned in your lecture, that there's no difference between creation and creator, and there's no good and evil, and we have to stay aware in the situation when there is suffering. So my question is, how to control your mind at the time when you are in suffering? So can you explain that? How do you mean to? Thank you.
I think you really meant to address that question to the Swami. Because I already had a question, so it's really his turn. So... I got in you. You're asking a question that I struggle with all the time. Which is to say, it's very easy to give a talk and say that. It's a completely other thing to actually do it. And you know the famous dictum, those who can't teach. I think it is a profound spiritual practice to be able to be in the throes of pain or a mind storm or some form of emotional or psychological suffering or physical suffering and to remain connected to the divine. And not only to remain connected, but to see divinity in that moment. If you're asking me practically, there are two ways to do this. One is simply to sit with what is difficult and painful and troubling and try and remain disconnected from it, not to be swallowed up by it. Again, it's very easy to say, how does one do that? To try to do that. The other way of doing this is exactly the reverse, and that is to, when in the throes of a difficult period of time, suffering, serious suffering, to sit with and to allow oneself to be present with the suffering exactly as it is, and to know it exactly as it is. I believe the meditation instructions for that kind of situation would be to be with the thoughts or the feelings or the sensations in the body, the physical pain, whatever it might be, and to be with them as completely, with as much awareness and as consciousness as one can bring to them. And specifically, to be able to feel the suffering in the body. That is to say, if it's a mind storm, if it's troubling emotions, if it's anger or rage or impatience or jealousy or some other very difficult emotion, to try and feel where it is in the body, to see whether it is hot or cold, whether it vibrates in the body, whether it cramps in the body, whether it's in the chest or the throat or in the face or in the belly or in the back, where one actually feels it, and to be with the sensations of the body and to feel grounded. When we're connected to the sensations of the body, we feel grounded and we don't lose ourselves. And again, I say this is much easier said than done, but I suggest that as a meditation instruction for when it gets difficult. Finally, there is a famous rabbinic story about a great spiritual master whose name was Nachum Ish Gamzu, which literally translates as Nachum, the man of this also. And this is why Nachum, the man of this also, was such a great sage. Because in the Talmud, it relates about him that whatever happened to him in his life, whatever moment he was experiencing, his response was, this also is for the good. This also is for the good. This is a very high spiritual level. But I find that if I can remember at any given moment to say, this also is for the good, this experience too is for the good, then maybe in that moment of suffering, I will actually find the meaning of that moment for myself. Please ask the Swami a question. He's a very good man.
What is Swami's answer for this?
I agree with the rabbi. Yeah, these are two questions. One is, how do we deal with suffering, and why is there suffering? And we don't have very good answers for either one. There's an incident that took place towards the end of Sri Ramakrishna's life. There was a devotee who came from Sindh, over 1,000 miles away, to see Sri Ramakrishna. His name was Hirananda. Sri Ramakrishna was anxious to see the two of them have an argument or a discussion, something like that. They were hesitant to do it. But finally, this Hirananda very sweetly said to Swami Vivekananda, who's still Narendra, 20, probably 21 years old at that time, he said, why should a devotee of God suffer? Because he saw Sri Ramakrishna with this terrible throat cancer. So Narendra's answer was, the plan of this world is devilish. I could have created a better world. And then this Hirananda pressed him. And he said, oh yeah, what would you have done? And he said, well, I'm not exactly giving my plan, but I could do it better. So anyhow, the point is that was there some need for the terrible suffering that we see? Was there some other way that this world could have come into existence? These are such speculative questions that it's really impossible to answer. How we deal with situations that arise, that again is mostly a question of the attitude that we want to take, because there's no definitive answer. So how do I deal with it when certain situations come, that physical suffering or mental suffering? There are different ways that we can look at it. This also is one way. The other way is, this too shall pass. We can take a long view. And if we look over all the things that took place in our lives, some of the most terrible incidents, we thought it would never end. But it ends. And we get over it and we go on. We can look at it from the point of view of karma. If this is some karma that is causing this, and I'm getting over that, this present suffering, this present pain or illness, whatever, is the cause of my eliminating that bad karma, then let it come. Give me more suffering. Let me get over this quickly, this karma. We can look at it from that point of view. I sometimes look at it from the point of view of the law of averages. Yeah, really. If we stop and think that whatever horrible tragedy there is, it's some of the worst things we can think about, that say a child dies. Now, if we think that there'll be a certain number of children that will die, that parents will have to watch children die, there'll be a certain number. Why should it always be someone else? If it happens to me, it's saving someone else. I remember a story told about one of the past presidents of our order, Swami Bhuteshanandaji, a very great, very wonderful Swami. He was called to Belermut, and he was warned ahead of time, they want to send you to this one of these centers that was very troublesome, Chedapunji. They sent him there at the time. And they said, you better refuse. You'll be sorry if you have to go. There are a lot of political problems and everything else. So they called him in, and he said to the headquarters, General Secretary, he said, Maharaj, please forgive me. Yeah, let me have some other posting. So they said, all right. They liked him very much and everything. Then he went back, and he heard one of his brother monks was chosen to fill that position. And then it dawned on him, because I wanted to get out of a difficult situation, someone else has to get into that difficult situation. So I want to be the one who saved from cancer. I want to be the one who saved from tragedy. That means that we're asking someone else to do it. If we accept this idea, that there'll be a certain number that have to suffer from this. So these are all different ways that we can look at these things. Of course, Sri Ramakrishna liked this idea of what he called Sharanagati. This means perfect surrender. And he used to give the illustration of the kitten. The kitten would go wherever the mother cat puts it. It didn't decide. And sometimes the mother cat would put it on the master's bed, very soft and comfortable. Sometimes it would put it even in the ashes in the fireplace. Now, the kitten felt that if my mother has put me here, this must be the best place for me. So if we can take that attitude, no matter what happens, it's for my good. No matter what suffering I go through, it's for my good. Whether it's literally true or not, who can say? But if we take that attitude, then we'll benefit from it. Sri Ramakrishna used to say, Jamon Bhab Temni Lab. He said this over and over again. As is our attitude, so is our gain. If we can find some way to understand these things, forget about whether it's literally true. We can't prove it one way or the other. Was it really my karma? Was it really this? Was it chance? Was it God's will? We don't know. We take the attitude that helps us get through, because this life is a tough thing. There's no way to avoid suffering. We have to find the best way to elevate our minds above it. Of course, if we can distance ourselves and be the witness, if we can feel that, no, I'm not this body or this mind, I'm that spirit within, that will also be helpful in relieving some of the pain and suffering, but not completely. This is the meaning of life, suffering. We have the whole Buddhist philosophy based on that. Everything is suffering. So this world is like that. If it weren't like that, who would seek anything higher? So we can also take that point of view.
I'd just like to add one other word, which is that whether it is you who are suffering or someone else you know who is suffering, it is of the utmost importance to have compassion. Compassion for the self, compassion for the other.
Hi, I'd briefly like to express my thanks to both of the speakers, Swami and the rabbi, and I'd like to address my question to two of them. So, Swami, I'll ask you first. It has to do with the Bible. What it says in the beginning, there is the Word, and then the second part of my question is, we're made, according to the Bible, in God's image and likeness. What is the image? What is the likeness? What is the difference between the two? Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a statement in the Bible, in the beginning was the Word. Anybody know the rest of it? And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And this is from St. John. John. Boy, did you ask the wrong two people. <I know. laughs> I can give you a Vedantic answer. I can give you an answer in terms of what the Christian Bible, what kind of answer. As far as I know, this has something to do with the birth of Christ, right? In Vedanta, we can say the beginning was the Word. Now, we have this idea of Shabda Brahman. Shabda Brahman is a way of looking at Brahman. If Brahman is projecting this universe, projecting it as some type of vibration, as sound, this initial sound can be thought of sometimes as Om. And this Om is that sound from which everything is contained. Or we can say the Veda. Veda is also Shabda, the scripture and word and sound. Everything is contained in that. If we think of this analogy of a dream. Suppose we say, well, the Brahman is dreaming all of this. Now, when we have a dream, there has to be some storehouse of material out of which this dream can be manufactured, or subconscious, right? There's also a storehouse of elements of creation, and this is one of the explanations for Veda, this knowledge and these divine ideas that can be manifest in the form of tangible things. So this is one way of understanding how in the beginning was the word or sound or this Om or some subtle storehouse world of ideas. We find the same thing in the Platonic philosophy. Now, this doesn't answer your question at all because I don't know. I don't know the real answer. What was the second? The image of God.
Kerr, I think it was Om. That's what I had arrived at.
Okay.
A vibrational word.
Okay.
And the second one, I guess it's
created
kind
in
of
the
unfair.
Image of God.
Yeah, we're created in the image and likeness of God. I wanted to know what the difference was between the image and the likeness.
I have no idea.
I don't either.
I would say.
Thank you for trying.
Yeah. I take this as meaning that however we look upon the real self or the soul within, that it's the same substance as God. Whether we're dualists and say that we come out of God, or whether we're non-dualists and say that God himself dwelling within, in either case, that the substance, the nature of the self, if we analyze it, is nothing but consciousness, the pure consciousness. There's a purity to that. It gets mixed up with the mind and the senses and the ego and personality. But that's all superimposition. In reality, it's that pure Brahman, which is the same pure consciousness as this transcendent Brahman. So transcendent, immanent, one and the same. So if we want to think that we're created in the likeness of God, we can think of it in terms of this higher self within and this higher self within the entire universe as being one and the same.
So both the rabbi and the swami have spoken of this very expansive concept of God. And my question is about how can I have some kind of bridge from my childhood concept of the very personal God. Like Rabbi Psalm 139, you know, you knew me when I was knitted in my mother's womb. You know, some entity that loves me as a unique human being, and how to bridge from that to this very expansive God that you're describing, who cannot be named, and it seems a bit more general. How do I move from relating to that childhood image and that childhood experience to an adult spirituality?
Did somebody say oy vey? Did I hear everyone? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that you're right. You're right. You know, this is also a very personal question to me because it's something that I have worked with for a good part of the last 20 years. Somehow finding peace between my childhood yearning for the divine partner, the divine parent or lover, and this absolute monism of the oneness, the being of the nameless and the formless. Ultimately, what I briefly want to say is, you don't need to give up one for the other. I don't think you need to give up one for the other. Sometimes we are in a state of such complete quiet and stillness that there is nothing. There is nothing. There's no us. There's no one asking the question. There's no one giving the answer. There's just the nameless and the formless. And those moments are exquisite. They're blissful. But sometimes my heart yearns to be connected to the other with the capital O, with the lover who is the love of the love of my life, the love of my soul. On Friday nights, there is a hymn that we sing called Yedid Nefesh, the beloved of my soul. It's a poem of love for the other, the one we choose to give our lives to, that we want to cleave to, the ones we want to merge with. And the last line is, I have to say it in Hebrew in order to get the English, Maher Ahuv Kiva Moed, hurry, my love, hurry, come quickly, because the time has come. It's the passion of a teenage lover who can't wait to embrace the love of his life. And I find that personally, I find that extraordinarily compelling, extraordinarily compelling. I mentioned earlier the great Hasidic rabbi, the sainted spiritual leader for whom I was named. And I spoke of him as being God intoxicated. He saw God everywhere. Everywhere he went, and everything that he did was with this passion for the divine, so much so he was so ecstatic over it that there are so many wonderful stories about him where he would go to the well to draw water to bake matzah, and he was so enthralled with the mitzvah of baking matzah that he would fall into the well. He couldn't control his body. Or the Passover night at the first Seder, where he raised the wine goblet to say the Kiddush, the blessing over the wine that sanctifies the time, and he started to tremble, and he grabbed onto the dining room table and the white tablecloth, and he fell over, pulling the whole tablecloth with him. And he couldn't control himself, and I'm named for him, which explains why I'm such a klutz. But he simply couldn't control himself, and that level of passion speaks to me in a very profound way. So I just want to say, don't give up on that childhood connectedness, that childhood passion. Just understand that the object of our passion, or the subject of our passion, is not what deity is not what divinity is, but it's a manifestation of divinity in the way that we can understand it, and we need at that moment in time. We need it at that moment in time, and be blessed by it.
I mentioned earlier about Sri Ramakrishna's ability to deal with these very subtle, very high philosophical truths in a very simple way. And one of the things that he was a genius at was at explaining this relationship between the impersonal absolute and the personal God. God with form, God without form, and all of the different manifestations, God is transcendent, God is immanent, belonging to one and the same reality, not two separate things. And he gave us many beautiful illustrations of how this infinite absolute can take a concrete form for us. He says, through the power, the cooling power of devotion, the devotee's heart, that the water will form into blocks of ice, take a particular shape, a particular form, so that we can worship that. And when the sun of knowledge comes up, it'll melt back into the ocean, into the formless absolute. But it's the same. Even if we take this very personal concept of God as having a very distinct form, even many arms and weapons and all sorts of things that we find in the Hindu tradition, we may say that I'm superimposing these different ideas that I have about God on this impersonal, formless reality. Now, it may be true, but the essence of it is still God. It's still the portion that I've projected on top of it is only for the sake of making it tangible for me. The reality is one and the same. So we shouldn't think that if somebody says, oh, you're just imagining that. Somebody says, no, God can't be sitting on a throne with a long beard. It doesn't make any sense. We're not worshiping God, the physical part of it. We're giving ourselves something concrete to think about. So we can fix the mind on that. Now, the other thing is that I sometimes feel that we get things reversed, this idea of impersonal absolute and personal God, that we think of the personal God as the distant one, that we're the God who's in heaven, and the impersonal absolute as the one dwelling within, as the higher self. For me, the transcendent aspect is the impersonal aspect. And God dwelling within, this is the personal God. When God dwells within the heart, God takes the shape of the heart. I mentioned earlier about scooping water, that God is formless. Now, water is formless, but we never find it in a formless condition. Even in the ocean, it takes the shape of the bed of the ocean. So even though God, we can say, is formless, we don't access that. If we want to access the formless God, we have to dive in the ocean. If we want to take the water, we have to put it in a container. That container will give us a conception of God that we can form a relationship with. Now, God dwelling within, we have a conception of God as the witnessing consciousness, which is also some kind of impersonal conception. But there's another conception which speaks of that indwelling presence as the antaryamin. This means the inner controller, the inner guide, the friend within that we can feel that connection to. And we can feel it in a much stronger way than if we feel that we're praying to a God in a heaven far away. If we can have that understanding that, yes, that is the personal God within. There was a very interesting statement made by Ramana Maharshi. Somebody asked him, who is the personal God? And he said, that which says I. A very tremendous statement. That means that you're the personal God. I am the personal God. But I'm putting myself on one side and seeing that personal God on the other side. That stick that separates both sides. So we have that idea also. And partly it's a question of faith also. It's a question of faith that we accept this idea that God has some type of personality. Now, the personality of God can't be our conception of personality. Right? What is our conception of personality? Identification with the body, identification with the ego, with the mind. Do we think that God is also suffering from that delusion of false identification with all of these other things. It can't be. What I understand is that this pure consciousness has a power to it. First of all, it's not simply consciousness, it's reflexive consciousness. It's not simply the light of knowledge, but it knows itself. I am that I am. This is the essence of that personal God, that there's some self-awareness there. And the same infinite absolute has this power to project the universe. What does that mean? That means that it's the creator also. Now, the Vedantic idea is that God as creator and God as the infinite absolute both exist side by side because it's one and the same reality. They're not two separate things. If we take the example of a woman is a woman. As soon as a woman gives birth to a child, she's a mother. And there's a personal relationship between the mother and the child. Now, the woman becoming a mother, does that mean she ceases to be a woman? Or less a woman, 100% a woman, and 100% mother. But this mother aspect is temporary. Sometimes it's potential, sometimes it's actual. When there's no universe, there's no creator God. There's no Ishvara, simply that infinite absolute reality. So I think we get into trouble a little bit when we think of the personal God based on how we think of ourselves as a person. If I say that my understanding of myself as a person is false, how can I attribute that same type of personality to God? So it must be some deeper type of personality, personhood, self-identification. God, I am that I am. Self-awareness and that ability to project the universe and enter into it as this higher sense of conscience, as this comforting power, as the source of joy and happiness. It's not the traditional belief in the personal God, perhaps, but it's a type of personal God that we can understand and that we can feel as being very, very close to us. Now, the last point I want to make is that this belief in a personal God and this belief in a little separation between ourselves, this is a question of choice, a question of what we like. There's a song that Sri Ramakrishna used to quote. It was written by a great devotee of the Divine Mother named Ram Prasad. And one line of this song says, I don't want to become sugar, I want to taste sugar. Now, that means that becoming sugar, that means I am, in my real essence, I am one with God. But I want to have a little separation to enjoy that relationship. So I'll keep a little sense of ego, but it'll be a transformed, it'll be a higher sense, not based on this body, mind, and everything, but based on a divine relationship. I'll think of myself as a child of God and enjoy that relationship with God. And when I look within and feel that I'm doing nothing, some power within is doing it, then I'll say, Mother is doing everything. Mother has become everything. Mother is doing everything. And I just have to rely on Mother. And when we eliminate this ego and that desire from our action, we can really feel that divine presence guiding us. So I think we have to let our concept of the personal God mature. We may have to give up the childhood concept of the personal God, but belief, as the rabbi said, belief in this infinite absolute reality is in no way in conflict with this idea of this indwelling, immanent, very close, loving presence within us, that blissful aspect of God or of the Divine Mother.
Hello, thank you. Over here. I'd like to ask a question of the rabbi and of the Swami. Coming back to something a little more human, grounded, kind of where the rubber meets the road between beingness and being, trying to see the divine and experience the divine, and that has to do with forgiveness. And we've kind of touched on that in many of your answers, and I would like for each of you to comment on the nature and understanding of forgiveness in the Kabbalah and in Vedanta, and specifically speak to self-forgiveness, because I think for me personally, that's where I have a veil. That's where my veil usually is, and when I can lift that veil, then I experience God. Thank you.
So in the Jewish tradition, there is a day called the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. This is a day in which Jews who participate in this practice spend all day examining their behavior and thinking about issues of forgiveness. And if you'll pardon the dualistic language, standing before God in judgment. It's one of the great misunderstood moments of Jewish life. It's perceived as this moment of great somberness, and particularly because the God of Judaism is often thought of, mistakenly in my opinion, as the angry and vengeful God of the Old Testament. That people misunderstand the nature of this day. But my ancestor, my sainted ancestor, had a wonderful teaching about the Day of Atonement. And he said as follows. He said, if I had committed some crime and I were called to court and the judge said to me, you're guilty of this act and you have to sentence yourself, then I would be completely lost. I would be completely lost because no one can be harsher on me than me. He said, but we don't stand before ourselves and we don't judge ourselves. We stand before the Blessed One, the Holy of Holy of Holies, the source of all being. And from that source, forgiveness has already come before we even ask. It means a great deal to me to realize that at the moment when I'm being harshest to myself, when I'm willing to beat myself harder than any other person would beat me, when I'm truly so mean to myself, more so than any other person would be or that I would be to any other person, this teaching reminds me that I stand constantly before a source of being that loves me with an infinite and unending love, and that is able to forgive me for things that I've done that I feel guilty about and for which I am ashamed. And that is a great source of enormous comfort. A great source of enormous comfort. So, briefly, when I find that I cannot forgive myself, I try to remember that the Holy Blessed One has already embraced me and can show me the way to forgiveness. And I hope that's a little bit helpful.
So there are really two questions here, right? One forgiving ourselves, the other forgiving others. Is that more or less who asked the question? Yeah, okay. We have to ask ourselves with regard to other people, really, who are we to forgive anyone? It means that we're putting ourselves in a position where we're judging other people when we don't know what their motives were, we don't know what their thinking was. Even people who do the most horrific things, if we could get inside of their heads, we might find that they're doing what they think is absolutely justified to do. So it's very difficult for us to judge others, and also to feel that we have some power to forgive. Holy Mother gave her very final message that was, we should try not to see the faults of other people. Now, the reason she said that wasn't because there's some moral imperative. It's not that it's a sinful thing to do. She said, if you want peace of mind. So really, it's a question of where we want to keep our mind, where we want to let our thoughts dwell. We can very easily spend our time finding fault with other people, nitpicking. But it doesn't do us any good. Certainly doesn't help anyone else. It doesn't do us any good. If we want to find faults, she said, we should look and see our own faults. Now, the other half of this is that we don't want to spend too much time looking at our own faults. And this idea of looking at ourselves as sinful people, this is something that Sri Ramakrishna absolutely didn't like and Swami Vivekananda absolutely didn't like. He said, it's standing liable to call yourself a sinner. You children of divine bliss, children of immortality, how dare you call yourself a sinner? So with regard to ourselves, we should always look towards that divine presence within. And Sri Ramakrishna used to say, yes, if you've done something wrong, just resolve not to do it again and give it up. Don't dwell on it. There's nothing to be gained by it. Yes, I know I shouldn't have done that. I recognize my mistake. I won't do it again. That's all. We should not be too harsh on ourselves. We have to find a balance. We have to be introspective. We have to see where we need to work on ourselves. We have to find out what our shortcomings are so that we can improve ourselves. But we shouldn't dwell on it. We should always take a very positive attitude and feel that divine presence within. This feeling that divine presence, feeling ourselves to be the witness, this attitude solves half of the problems that we have. So this idea of forgiveness, yeah, I hear people talk about that, you know, should I forgive that person? Well, it's not really up to us. It may be a question of that person's her own karma, or whatever results will come from that. I shouldn't feel myself a part of that whole thing. I shouldn't be the one to have to say, yes, it's okay. Because that puts me in a position above the other person. If the other person feels happy, if I say, oh, it's okay, then of course we can do that. But what we do and what other people do, the results will come. This karma theory is there. That no matter what, we can't relieve someone of their karma. We can't say, I forgive you the way God could say, I forgive you, from a dualistic point of view, and say, now you're cleansed of that. We can't do that. So everything is an attitude of the mind. But the most important thing is we shouldn't be too hard on ourselves. Nobody's perfect. We didn't choose the mind that we're born with. This mind has all sorts of tendencies in it. And we shouldn't own it. We should say, yes, that's the nature of this mind that I have. I'll try to correct it. But we shouldn't think that because the mind acts that way, I'm that way. Because the mind makes bad decisions, I make bad decisions. Because the mind does bad things, I'm a bad person. We should try to get rid of that idea and feel that we're something separate from the mind. That's the instrument we've been given. And we have to make the best of it and try to use it as best we can. So that way we can get over this very bad habit of fault finding within ourselves and being too hard on ourselves.
First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers and the speakers for this very wonderful gathering, very worthwhile. And if you don't mind, I'd like to depart from the personal and speak about the world. And I know that on everybody's mind is world peace and world unity, and I think religion has a great role to play in this. And in the Baha'i faith, we believe that we are the dawn of world peace and world unity, predicated
mainly on the spiritual unity of mankind. So my question has to do with spiritual evolution. In everything in life, in science, education, culture, civilization, the arts, in everything we always add the word evolution to it because that's what makes it alive and future-looking. But when it comes to religion, it seems that we've been imprisoned in some sort of ancestral belief systems which have divided mankind. Perhaps if we were to look at it from a distance and see the oneness of the Creator, the oneness of His message, which has been transferred to humanity through manifestations of God or prophets of God, who have shared to mankind values progressively. And today, maybe we should bring this to the table in view of achieving the spiritual component which is necessary in achieving world peace. So I would like to know what are your comments as far as how can we achieve this evolution in spirituality and progressive revelation so that all the peoples of the world can be assured that whatever traditions they were believing in forever, they were believing in the truth. But however, the future is in common, and this is the time that we need to come together as one family, one world, one truth.
Well, amen to you. That is exactly, seems to me, you've stated the problem and you've stated the solution. So I think you're absolutely right. And look at, we are sitting in this tent, which is transformed into an incredibly sacred space. And it's transformed into an incredibly sacred space because of the intention of the people who create this day here as a sacred moment of bringing people together. And here we are. We are Jews and Hindus, we are Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, Baha'i. We represent a whole spectrum of faith paths and spiritual paths here in this room. And yet we are able to sit together peacefully without coming to fisticuffs, without throwing any punches, and we're able to talk about God and our belief in God and our desire for God and our yearning for God. And we're able to talk about this very openly and enjoy a lunch on the lawn that was extraordinarily delicious and beautiful and joyful. And we have this extraordinary day. We have this beautiful day. Why is that possible? Why is that possible? It seems to me that we have engaged in, we have an intention and we've engaged in a worldview that allows us to connect with each other without the need to be special, without the need to be more than, without the need to be right, but simply to enjoy each other's company as fellow seekers on the path towards peace and harmony and well-being and higher consciousness and a relationship with the divine. And if we were to embrace the kind of language, I truly believe that Judaism is desperately in need of this mystical language that I spoke of earlier in order to elevate it and to evolve it, to go back to that ancient mystical language in order for us to be able to evolve in the way that will enable us to live in peace with our neighbors, I mean, wherever we may be found. And I believe that's true for all of us. So there's something magical that's taking place in this tent today. And if we could but harness that and understand that and share it with other people one at a time, maybe we would make a difference and perhaps the world would turn out exactly the way that you envision it. I hope it does.
I also hope so, but I am not so terribly optimistic. So, first thing is that we should all strive for this. Whether it's possible or not possible, forget about that. We should all take it as our personal responsibility to live in such a way that if everyone lived like that, it would be a joyful world. We have to at least try that. Whether it's possible that it will actually take place, that's a different story. That's not in our control. But if we can have that as an ideal, if we can strive for that, then it'll be a blessing for the world and a blessing for ourselves. This is the other thing, that it's a very joyful way to live with that feeling of openness and oneness and unity and everything. Now, from the other side, if we want to get a little pessimistic here, Swami Vivekananda said once that more blood has been shed in the name of religion than anything else in the world. So we find that that very power which can lead to good has a tremendous power to lead to just the opposite, because of this tendency that we have to think in terms of us and them. Even with God, I was mentioning before about this, the very bad conception we have of the personal God, which is based entirely on our own conception of ourselves. We have such a limited idea of what it means to be good, and we attribute goodness to God. We have such a tendency towards jealousy that we assume God will be jealous also. Right? There's no other way of doing it. That our capacity to understand God is so limited to our capacity to understand ourselves. What do we mean by goodness? What do we mean by openness, by compassion? Our idea of compassion is also limited. This is why Swami Vivekananda said these great souls are born on earth. They can exhibit true compassion in a way that's far greater than we can even imagine. If somebody says, try to think of the most compassionate person you can think of, it won't be close to what we see in the life of Holy Mother, for example, or any of the great realized souls that we have. So this tendency of the human mind towards limitation, towards personalizing things, towards thinking in terms of us versus them, has the exact opposite effect on religion. And what we have to do is keep up this effort to universalize, keep up this effort to look at this, what we can call this mystical side of religion. Let religion be a force that unites people. Now it's a force that separates people to a great extent, because we think my God, and God loves my country. God loves my people more than any other people. It's a conception of God based on our own smallness, and we have to learn to transcend that. Now, whether this world will ever become perfect and there'll be world peace, as I say, I have my doubts. This is the world, after all. As Swami Vivekananda says, there'll be an equal amount of good and bad, suffering and joy in this world. There'll be ups and downs and everything, but we have to strive for it, and we have to have some hope that progress can be made, and at least do our part, at least feel that I've contributed to the betterment of things, and I haven't made things worse, at least. So we can be realists and at the same time be idealists. Yeah, realistically, I will say I'm not so sure this world will ever become perfect. But ideally, I can say, let me be a force for good. Let me try.
Rabbi and Swamiji, earlier I heard from Rabbi the word Ein Sof. I hope I'm saying it correctly. It sounds like a Hebrew word for Brahman. And Swamiji, I heard from you about Brahman, which is like a Sanskrit word for Ein Sof. Could you comment on the similarities or differences between the two concepts?
They seem pretty similar to me. I heard a lot of similarities, actually, today. Remarkable similarities. I heard words being taught in the name of Sri Ramakrishna that I've heard come from the teachings of Hasidic masters. How is that possible? How is that possible? And I'll tell you what I think is that there are certain spiritual truths in the world that are universal truths. And they are discovered by different spiritual masters at different times in different ways, and sometimes in slightly different language, and sometimes in the same language. And when you hear one of those spiritual truths, it's like when you ping fine crystal and it goes ping, you know, and it's got that ring of perfection to it, then you recognize that there is a truth there. And if you hear the same teaching here and here and here and here, then there's a good chance that we're talking about a universal spiritual truth. And I'm so profoundly moved by this teaching that I've been privileged to hear today from the Swami that I'm just speechless, which never happens to me.
Ein Sof, and it literally means without end?
Without end.
Yeah, without boundaries. This, of course, is one of the main descriptions that we have of Brahman. Now, the Brahman is beyond description, so every so-called description we have is negative. So it's beyond this, beyond that. We can't touch it, we can't smell it, we can't feel it. And one of them is beginningless and endless, this ananta. Ananta, endless, is one of the terms that we use. That doesn't mean that it's so huge or that it'll take so long to get there. It means it's beyond everything, transcendent, that there's nothing physical, there's nothing material, there's no parts to it. It's perfectly pure, beyond everything. And at the same time, it's consciousness, it's the self. It's something very tangible because we are that. So it's the most unknown thing and the most known thing, because we all know I exist. I know that I exist. People say, how do you prove the existence of God? I'll say, well, maybe not your concept of God, my concept of God, because I am. If I can say I am, that proves the existence of God, of Brahman, of consciousness. And it's beyond name and form. It's beyond mind and speech. If that weren't so, we couldn't have these different personal conceptions of God. The infinite absolute, the nameless and the formless, is always the ground for that which has name and form. It allows that. If water is not formless, it can't take a particular shape. If it had its own form, then one would be true and one would be false. If it had an actual form to it, like a physical object. But it doesn't. It has to be formless to take every other form. So this is how that one infinite Brahman can be worshipped in all different ways with different names and forms, but ultimately we have to say is without boundaries. So the conceptions are perfectly in harmony.
Hello. Yeah. I am, like most others here and like the previous questioner, I'm intrigued by the similarities between what we heard about the Kabbalah and the similarities with the Brahman of Vedanta, the little I understand of it. Now, my question is much simpler, and it's for the rabbi primarily, is that when did these concepts of Kabbalah really develop? Did they come to the old prophets like Moses and Isaiah down to our days, or that was a later development from the first century BC to later on? And how did it exactly develop? Because we, on the outside of the Jewish faith, seem to know so little about this vastness of that concept and its similarities.
Thanks for that easy question. Finally. So Kabbalah is very ancient, but it does not appear in the Bible. So it's not from the time of Moses or Isaiah or any of the prophets. It's not biblical. The likelihood is that sometime in around the 4th and 5th century of the Common Era, what is commonly referred to as AD, the 4th or 5th century AD, the same sages, the same rabbis who were creating normative Judaism recognized that normative Judaism was simply the surface of what it is that they could understand about the world and about divinity. And they started to develop these Kabbalistic notions that went far deeper and that focused specifically on the nature of the divine, which has been our conversation here. So already in the Talmud you find a very famous story of four sages who enter into the Pardes. They enter into paradise. Pardes is a Persian word that means garden. And paradise is the English version of the Persian word that means garden. They entered into the garden. They entered into the garden of secrets. And three of them came out damaged. Only one went in peace and came out in peace. Rabbi Akiva went in peace and went out in peace because, according to the Talmud, he and he alone had an understanding of the infinite, formless, and nameless Holy One of Being, which is Ein Sof or Brahman, and he was the only one who was able to come out in peace. The Kabbalah takes full shape between the years 1175 and 1298, mostly in Provence and in Guadalajara, Spain. In Provence, it was the center of Kabbalah. There were a variety of different rabbis, all of whom lived this very normative life, but at the same time, they were raging ecstatics and contemplatives. Rabbi Isaac the Blind in Provence writes the very first Kabbalistic book in which he talks about the source of all being overflowing from its wellspring to create the physical universe through the divine manifestations of the 10 Sefirot. And in 1289, a man by the name of Rabbi Moses de Leon writes a book that he claims he channeled, which I'm now of the belief that he probably did, which it's taken me quite some time to actually come to be able to admit, but he probably channeled this book. In other words, I believe that an ancient sage came to him and dictated this work to him. And Rabbi Moses de Leon wrote a book called the Zohar. The Zohar in Hebrew means splendor or enlightenment, the Book of Enlightenment. And the Zohar became the central work of Jewish mysticism. And it is correct what the Swami said earlier this morning, that for a period of not only decades, but certainly maybe a century or more, Jewish mysticism was completely normative and was embraced by everyone until, for a variety of reasons historically, it became too hot to handle and it went underground. For a very specific historical reason. But Kabbalah developed from the 4th or 5th century CE through the 13th and 14th century until it became, and then actually later into the 16th century, until it became a very fully well-blown, fully formed ideology and philosophy, mystical philosophy. In the late 1700s, a man by the name of the Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Israel Baal Shem, who is the founder of the Hasidic movement, took what was a very intellectually ponderous system of Kabbalistic thinking, and he whittled it down to a variety of fundamental teachings. One is, there is no place without divinity. Divinity is everything, everywhere, all the time. The second is, the fundamental dynamic of the universe is giving and receiving, loving kindness and boundary. There is love and there is awe, and we need to learn how to stand in a place of love and how to stand in a place of awe. And he created what became the Hasidic movement, which was the ultimate form of Jewish renewal. And now I'm very happy to let you know that there is a contemporary Jewish renewal movement that exists today that is a form of neo-Hasidism that is taking these insights of the Kabbalistic movement and evolving them to make sense in a world of egalitarianism and universalism, and struggling with medieval language to try and transform it into the kind of language that doesn't separate people but actually brings people together. So in a nutshell, that's a history of the development of Kabbalah, and I'm so happy that that there is a next chapter being written and that I get to play a very, very small role in helping to shape it.
I have a question now. Thank you so much for all that's being expressed today, how wonderful it is for us to be together. Last Monday, I held my mother as she transitioned, and the spiritual part of myself, if I could say, handled it beautifully. Now that little girl inside me wants to know when I'm going to see my mommy again. And I'm not at peace with that. Spiritually, my mother was all of her life Orthodox Jewish. She held that belief before anything else. And her passing was exactly that. We gave her that. We gave her an Orthodox funeral. It was beautiful, beautiful. She was buried next to my father, and they are together, and somewhere spiritually, I believe they are together now, which gives me a lot of peace. But I'm wondering what the belief is about when one transitions. The little girl in me wants to know that I'm going to see her again when I transition. It's a little girl's question. I wonder if you could help me with that, please. Thank you.
First, let me offer my profoundest and deepest condolences to you on your loss. How painful that must be to see a beloved mother pass away. I think everyone in this room who's suffered such a loss, that all of our hearts go out to you. And we can only hope and pray that you will find some comfort, perhaps a little bit of comfort on the road to greater comfort. I heard two different questions, and I want to make sure that I'm addressing whether these are both your questions and whether I'm addressing the one that you're interested in. I'm very moved by the notion of by your description of yourself as the little girl who wants to see her mommy again, and you said that you were okay spiritually with it, but there's a part of you that's still in great pain. And I can only say that pain is excruciatingly real, and the only way through it is through it. You know, to sit with it, to be with it, and to let it be okay. You have the right to grieve and to give yourself time to grieve. I'm not suggesting that you engage in any specific ritual, because only you know what your spiritual path is. But the Jewish ritual of sitting Shiva is very powerful. I think it's one of the best things the Jewish people ever designed, because what it really says is take time, take 7 days to sit with the grief that you feel and to share it with people who are there not to talk you out of it, or to tell you it's going to be all right, or that it's time to feel something else, but to share it with people who are going to simply be willing to accept your pain and hold you as you feel it. And find a way to talk a lot about your mom. find a way to talk a lot about your mommy so that you can feel that profound connection that comes from being a little girl and a teenager and an adult woman. And feel that. Feel it as fully as you can. And I want to offer permission for you and blessing for you to do that. So I also heard you ask whether you'll see your mommy again. And I think you're asking about what happens in the afterlife. So there are a couple of things here. Kabbalistically, from the perspective of the Jewish mystical tradition, the first thing that you ought to know is that while the body doesn't necessarily survive, there is a soul, a spirit, which is divinity imbued in the body. And that soul does survive. That soul doesn't die. And that soul has different parts to it. Five different sections of that soul. Five different parts. And part of the soul, the most elevated part of the soul, actually returns immediately to the divine and lives in the light of the divine. Lives back in its place of origin, in a state of bliss. And then there is a part of the soul that remains on earth with the living and which has a hard time leaving, because the soul remembers how much it and the body loved the people that they loved, and they can't tear themselves away. And so the Kabbalah describes souls traveling back and forth between the cemetery or a final resting place and the home where they lived and the people that they loved. And that soul doesn't want to go. It doesn't want to let go of you because of the profound love that it has had for you all these years. Sometimes it's possible that we feel that there is a visitation from that soul. Sometimes it comes to us in a dream. And sometimes it comes to us in the shape of a butterfly or a bird or an animal or some experience that we have, walking quietly along a road by ourselves or sitting by ourselves with our grief. So there is the possibility of that visitation to experience that. And that part of the soul, ultimately in Kabbalistic, in the Kabbalah's teaching, that part of the soul will ultimately make its way to the divine. It also makes its way to the divine. The Kabbalah teaches that it takes 11 months for that journey. It's sort of like a bardo journey in Tibetan Buddhist teaching. It takes 11 months. The teaching of the Jewish people is that saying the mourner's Kaddish, you know, that Yitkadal v'Yitkadash Shemei Rabbah prayer, it's not a prayer, it's a doxology, it's a statement. Saying the mourner's Kaddish, when a child says a mourner's Kaddish for the soul of a parent, it actually elevates the soul and helps it on its journey. So each time you can do something to say those words or other words, or to have 2 or 5 minutes of conscious remembering every day, you can help elevate your mommy's soul, the soul part that wants to be reunited with the divine. Reunited with the divine. And ultimately, the Kabbalah teaches two things. Part of the soul will be recycled. Part of the soul will be reincarnated. Because each soul has a task to perform in life. And if the task is not complete, if the tikkun of our soul, if the repair and healing of our own souls are not complete, if the task for which we were born and created is not complete, then the soul returns. Not to mention the messes that we make that have to be cleaned up a little bit. So there will be, the Kabbalah teaches, there will be a reincarnation of part of that soul. But part of that soul will always remain with the divine, waiting for all those who knew that soul to join it. And the belief of the Kabbalah is you most certainly will know your mom again, and that you will be reunited in a place of light and bliss, And where the chant that we did earlier today, Ahava Rabba Ahavtanu, we are embraced by an unending love, where it is not simply words or a prayer, but it is a reality, a spiritual reality, that we are embraced in that place by such an unending love that it is a state of complete bliss for us. And your soul, when the time comes, and the soul of your mother and your father, and all those who are dear to you, will all be there. And I believe that there will be a reunification of all those souls. That's what the Kabbalah teaches. That's what I choose to believe. And I hope in some way it brings you comfort. Please, may you be comforted.